This is Milton Rosenberg welcoming you to the podcast of the same name, and welcoming to the program Michael Rubin, who's talking to us from Washington, where he is a resident scholar in foreign affairs at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael, good morning or good evening, depending upon when this is heard.
Thank you, Milton. Thanks for having me here.
I'm having you because of a most interesting book that you've done, which I've been reading with great fascination, titled Dancing with the Devil. And the devil of reference is made clear in the subtitle, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regimes. Such rogue regimes as what or who?
Well, you know, in international affairs, the idea of the rogue regime is somewhat akin to Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart's quip about pornography years ago, that it's hard to define, but I know it when I see it. But for the purposes of the book, what I wanted to do in order to have a definition was I adopted the definition put forward by the Clinton administration, because there's been an evolution of the concept of what is a rogue regime, but it really got encapsulated during the Clinton administration when, after the fall of the Soviet Union, suddenly we found ourselves confronting all these states which didn't abide by the norms of diplomacy, seemed to be immune from traditional deterrence, and also engaged in nuclear proliferation and or terrorism.
And name some of them.
Well, for example, North Korea, I guess, would be the marquee example of any rogue regime, but certainly the Islamic Republic of Iran as well. When you have a regime which takes over an embassy, I mean, violating the heart of the understanding of diplomacy, that pretty much is an example of a rogue regime. We have dealt with others in the past. Muammar Gaddafi, for example, up until at least 2003, was more likely to engage in terrorism and grew to be too bizarre in his diplomatic rants, even for his allies. You had the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which we think about as the Taliban. A lot of people forget that we negotiated at length with the Taliban before 9/11, but they certainly didn't have the same understanding of diplomacy that we do. And we could go into any numbers of other cases. The Palestine Liberation Organization, at least until 1993, when they signed the Oslo Accords, or the Muslim Brotherhood now.
Is negotiation essentially not possible of successful completion if you're dealing with a rogue regime, or for that matter, if you're dealing with a terrorist entity which doesn't have a full control of a state but is out there in the world doing much mischief?
I actually wouldn't go that far into to say that diplomacy never works. What I'm trying to argue about in the book, which, as you know, isn't a partisan polemic, because this problem of so-called rogue regimes is something which has confounded a bipartisan array of administrations going back 60 years. When you're having this sort of engagement with this sort of adversary that doesn't normally abide by the rules of diplomacy, we simply need to go in with eyes wide open. But this notion that's been put out there that it never hurts to talk is simply wrong. I mean, when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, she said, if you're not going to talk to your enemies, then who are you going to talk to? And she pointed out that Ronald Reagan sat down with Mikhail Gorbachev to negotiate the end of the Cold War. The problem was she forgot to mention that that happened after a 5-year military buildup in order to set the right circumstances. Unfortunately, in today's State Department, leverage has become a dirty word.
That brings to mind a saying I imagine authentically attributed to Winston Churchill, very simply, we arm to parley.
Indeed, and that is something which has been lost with time. Another issue which has been lost with time is that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We tend to sequence our strategies right now, where we will initially try diplomacy, and if that doesn't work, we'll try economic coercion, sanctions, for example. And if that doesn't work, we've had any number of presidents who will talk about how military options are the last resort. When we actually look at the history of diplomacy, when all of those strategies are taken in conjunction, that tends to be when we have the greatest leverage and the greatest success. One of the prime examples of this would be Muammar Gaddafi in 2003, when he agreed without a shot being fired to give up his nuclear program, and we know exactly why he made that decision. He said, subsequently, as did his advisors, that it was the U.S. military buildup ahead of the invasion of Iraq, which convinced him that our red lines weren't simply rhetorical, on top of which we had intercepted a ship carrying North Korean contraband to Libya's program, which convinced Gaddafi in 2003 that not only would he have to agree to talk, but more importantly, he'd have to agree to talk sincerely.
I would imagine that the beginning of his shift in attitude towards talking with us and talking sincerely began with the direct bombing attack upon his compound.
Well, indeed. I mean, during the Ronald Reagan administration, we did have those sorts of conflicts with Libya, which were more about the freedom of the sea. He certainly understood that Ronald Reagan was serious. However, what oftentimes happens, and this is one advantage which rogue regimes have over democracies, if it were, when it comes to diplomacy, is that he was simply shopping for a partner. He understood that Ronald Reagan would give him no ground, but in the waning weeks of the Reagan administration, of course, you had the Lockerbie bombing. Reagan, instead of responding immediately to Muammar Gaddafi, decided to basically let the president-elect, let George H.W. Bush take over. And George H.W. Bush wanted to work through multilateral channels. And Muammar Gaddafi figured that as soon as this got kicked to the United Nations and to international organizations, he would actually have greater leverage, on top of which he eventually went candidate shopping. Every 4 or 8 years, you have rogue regimes who will sit down and figure, should we stonewall now because we might get a better, more compliant American president in the Oval Office who will give us a better deal in the future?
Michael Rubin, let's do some rather close diplomatic history with a close examination, particularly of our dealings over the last few decades and still continuing dealings with a state of great prominence and of great potential danger for us and or for the world, namely with Iran. What's the history of U.S.-Iran relations after the coming of the first Ayatollah Khomeini?
Well, you know, one of the biggest misconceptions which is out there, and one of the ways conventional wisdom is wrong, is there's this perception that the Americans have never talked to the Iranians after the Islamic Revolution. But when you think about it, Ayatollah Khomeini returned to Iran on February 1, 1979. The U.S. embassy wasn't seized until November 4, 1979. That is 9 months later. Now, if we had severed diplomatic relations, we wouldn't have had diplomats there to be taken hostage in the first place. And indeed, even after our diplomats were taken hostage, we didn't break diplomatic relations with Iran until April of 1980, because the Carter administration wanted to keep hope alive for a diplomatic solution. But when you actually do a close read of what happened in the hostage crisis, there's several lessons which are out there. Number one is the importance of keeping military action on the table, because when the hostages were taken, you had a secret meeting back at the White House. There is an Iran aide in the National Security Council named Gary Sick, who still teaches at Columbia University today. He liked to talk to the press then as now, and he told the New York Times that that military action had been taken off the table. Well, when the Iranian negotiators, when the Iranian hostage takers saw this in the newspapers, they will write, and they have said in interviews in Persian, that is when they decided to take a 48-hour sit-in and amplify it into something that lasted 444 days. So sometimes keeping military action on the table is important. One other issue is the timing of diplomacy. Why did the embassy get taken that November? And it was because Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, decided to rush diplomacy with Iran. He met Iran's prime minister at the time, shook his hand. Someone took a photo of that. That photo made it back into the Iranian newspapers, and that was used as a reason to take the embassy to prevent this rapprochement. When you have uncertain diplomatic strands and when you have political infighting in a rogue regime, getting involved diplomatically can be quite dangerous. And indeed, this is a lesson which we continue to see to the current day with regard to Iran.
The October surprise, so-called, the freeing of the hostages once Jimmy Carter left office and Ronald Reagan was literally having a celebratory dinner directly after his inauguration. What does one make of all of that in historical context?
Well, you know, I think the person, let's dispense with the conspiracy theories which are out there, which were actually put forward by the same man, Gary Sick. The fact of the matter is Congress investigated and saw nothing untoward on the part of the Reagan campaign. Indeed, we know what happened. Frankly, Jimmy Carter was perceived as weak, and Ayatollah Khomeini figured he could take advantage of that. He was afraid, however, of Ronald Reagan and how Ronald Reagan might react. I think Peter Rodman, who was, as you know, one of Kissinger's top wonder boys, one of his top aides, he ultimately served as Assistant Secretary of Defense during the George W. Bush administration and unfortunately recently passed away of leukemia. He wrote a piece in 1981 in the Washington Quarterly in which he said all these statements and postmortems of the hostage situation in which it was written that the persistence of diplomacy is what paid off, those were dead wrong. What actually got the Iranians to change their mind and release the hostages was Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran. Simply put, once Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, the cost of Iran's isolation became too great to bear, so Khomeini had no choice but to try to break that isolation. That's when he released the hostages. Likewise, the only other time I can think of where Iran has pulled back from a declared policy in the face of immense pressure was what it would take to end the Iran-Iraq war. Of course, Khomeini had sworn that he was going to liberate Jerusalem, not only Iraq, but liberate Jerusalem. And so we had this war that lasted for 8 years at the cost of a million lives. Ultimately, Khomeini got on the radio and said, it's like drinking a chalice of poison, but if I want my regime to survive, I've got to accept a ceasefire. The question I have for American policymakers today is, if you want Iran to change course on its nuclear program, what is the policy equivalent that we have of forcing them to drink from a chalice of poison?
One of the strangest incidents in American-Iranian relations, and this involves people directly reporting to the president, was the so-called Iran-Contra deal, and one still remembers the cake presented to the Iranian representatives as if it were intended to take it back to Tehran or to Qom, wherever, to give the Ayatollah some special gustatory thrill.
Well, while many Americans remember the Iran-Contra affair in terms of the illegalities of bypassing Congress and so forth, it's important to understand that when we look at the root of the Iran-Contra affair, it was about diplomacy. It was about creating some sort of relationship with the Iranians, which we could then leverage after Ayatollah Khomeini's death. And ultimately, it's just one more example of, number one, what happens when you try to rush diplomacy against an insincere adversary, and number two, what happens when you have political infighting in your diplomatic partner? Because the Iran-Contra affair wasn't exposed by the New York Times. It was exposed by an enemy of Hashemi Rafsanjani inside Iran who didn't want to negotiate with the great Satan. By exposing these secret negotiations, he almost brought down the second term of the Reagan. He basically paralyzed the second term of the Reagan administration, and therefore that's a clear example of how diplomacy has a price.
What are we doing with Iran right now in terms of diplomatic contact? We certainly have for a long time been overtly concerned about their nuclearization program and trying to extort from them promises that they would at least slow down its pace, which they supposedly have done. But have we in fact been dancing with the devil? And is the devil playing his usual tricks just behind our back on that?
You know, I think one of the greatest problems we have in diplomacy is projecting our own sincerity onto our opponents. And at its root, this lies in the misunderstanding of what multiculturalism is. I spent 14 years in a Quaker school. Multiculturalism was drilled into me. It was about appreciating each other's differences, but it's not about walking into a sushi restaurant and being able to order a mojito. Fundamentally, we need to recognize that different people think in very, very different ways. So with regard to Iran, what are we doing now? Albert Einstein had a quip. He defined insanity as doing the same action repeatedly but expecting different results each time. We are going to Iran, and we are simply offering them, we are sitting down with them, pretending that they are negotiating sincerely. There's ample evidence that they're not. For example, Hassan Rouhani has outlined a doctrine of surprise in which he will lull America into complacency and then deliver a knockout blow. There's a great deal of cherry picking. A lot of American policymakers will look at the Supreme Leader as having blessed these talks because he talked about the need for heroic flexibility. What the New York Times didn't report, however, was in Persian, and as you know, I'm a Persian speaker, that he said that heroic flexibility is a change in tactics, not a change in policy. At the same time, we're completely ignorant of leverage. According to Iran's central bank, Iran's gross domestic product had shrank 5.4% in the year before we started negotiations. Now that is more or less recovered, plus we're giving them between $7 and $20 billion in sanctions relief and new investment. The equivalent of this is giving a five-year-old dessert first and then telling him you have to come to the table to eat your spinach.
And meanwhile, what are they doing with regard to the continued rush, or is it a truly more leisurely pace now, towards the achievement of nuclear weaponry?
Well, ultimately, I've traveled extensively in the Persian Gulf this year, and our allies in the Persian Gulf are convinced that Iran isn't going to cheat on any agreement, because the agreement is being constructed in such a way with so many loopholes that the Iranians can drive a truck through it. Ultimately, the Iranians have not pledged anything which is not reversible. They have not opened their nuclear military weaponry facility to inspectors. And one of the things to remember about the International Atomic Energy Agency, when people say, oh, Iran is going to allow IAEA inspections, is according to the IAEA's own documents, founding documents, it's only allowed to inspect declared nuclear facilities. This agreement does nothing to deal with the fact that Iran has what we suspect are secret facilities, and indeed, many of their uranium enrichment facilities to this date have been, at their origin, covert. So, in short, we are giving Iran a great deal of sanctions relief, and Iran is not doing anything to permanently end its enrichment capability or to explain its past cheating.
You've got an interesting overview, as presented in your new book, Dancing with the Devil, which I should add instantly is just recently published by Encounter Books, of the dilemma faced by the diplomat, or maybe the temptations faced by the diplomat, that getting the other side and the intractable and difficult people from the other side, from the rogue state or the rogue movement at the table, behaving more or less politely, that is a great achievement in and of itself, and that advances your career, and that's really the purview and the limited vision that the ordinary Western diplomat carries into negotiation. Do I summarize that correctly?
You do summarize that absolutely correctly. When you look at those who we consider to be our most famous diplomats now, people like Bill Burns, who's the Deputy Secretary of State, or Dennis Ross, who is oftentimes across administrations negotiating with the PLO, the fact of the matter is they got their diplomatic starts. They rose to fame by breaking through this idea that we shouldn't be talking to our enemies and sitting down with those who we once considered pariahs. Now, they have very little to show for their efforts, but it still has advanced their career. But, you know, there's a greater problem, Milton. I spend about a third of my time with the U.S. military. When I first started doing this, I was amazed that our men and women in uniform spend more time in the classroom going over their mistakes in order to learn from their mistakes than they actually do in the field. Our diplomats, over the course of the last 60 years, have never conducted a lessons learned exercise to determine why past diplomacy with rogue operators has gone wrong, and therefore we often repeat our mistakes. As I said before, the Clinton administration negotiated often with the Taliban before 2001. Now, we are negotiating with the same Taliban officials now, and yet we're expecting a different result. We have not explained.
What are we trying to get from them now?
Well, ultimately, that's one of the big questions. First of all, our diplomats tend to be allergic to metrics. We're not willing to state what exactly we want ahead of time so that we can judge whether our agreements are working or not. Ultimately, we want their compliance in a peaceful Afghanistan, after we withdraw. The problem is we're not withdrawing from a position of leverage. We're hemorrhaging our leverage first and then saying, well, let's all sing Kumbaya together, and that simply ain't going to work with the Taliban.
Well, are they in fact giving us, are they playing good cop, bad cop with us and giving us some reassurances in negotiation? Yeah, we're going to be nicer next time. After you've gone, we'll have a better Afghanistan and we won't kill as many people.
No, when you actually talk to Afghans, what they believe to be the Taliban's motivation in sitting down and talking with us is, number one, the immediate demand of getting some of their people out of prison. But number two, when they open an office in Qatar or when they open an office in Turkey, they suddenly have the ability to launder money on the global stage. It helps them financially. If that is their goal, then they have achieved their goal even before we have started our own agenda of conflict resolution.
One wonders, there are other great Western powers, once they were greater than they are now, perhaps, but England, or rather the UK, and France, and Germany, surely, are still very significant players in the world. And they've got the equivalent of our State Department, they've got foreign ministries, they've got diplomats everywhere. Do they play this game differently, or is that temptation toward being gratified merely by the fact of negotiation, is that temptation endemic to the species of Western diplomat?
I think it's actually endemic to the species of Western diplomats. It's hard to believe, but in many ways they're actually worse than our own. Their performance is worse than ours, and the reason perhaps is that our State Department tends not to act as autonomously as some of the foreign ministries in the European countries. But if we want to look, for example, at the Ukraine and what's going on with Russia, Steinmeier, who's Germany's foreign minister, well, he used to be chief of staff to Gerhard Schroeder, the chancellor of Germany, who, of course, went off to work for Gazprom. The French are still talking about selling helicopter carriers to Vladimir Putin. They simply delayed the decision on the deal. And the British are afraid to do anything which might impact the flow of Russian money into London because they don't want the London real estate market bubble to burst. Ultimately, we have mercantile interests affecting this, and there's a historical precedent to this. When you look back at the current negotiations with Iran right now, they have at their origin Klaus Kinkel, the German foreign minister's so-called critical dialogue, which began in 1993, which was, we're going to talk with you, but we're going to talk about some very tough subjects like human rights. But as soon as the Iranians started to complain, that human rights talk went off the agenda, and under both reformist President Mohammad Khatami and now under Hassan Rouhani, executions have skyrocketed as Westerners have sat down to talk.
Huh. Well, the alternative is to stop talking. You're not really advocating that, are you?
No, the alternative isn't simply to stop talking. The alternative is to talk from a position of strength, to talk better. Our opponents, and I experienced this when I lived in Iran, they used to call me in Iran Pasadi Shaitani Bozorg, which in Persian means son of the great Satan. They used to brag that Iranians play chess while the Americans play checkers. We tend to be very reactive. We've got to start being proactive. There's no reason why when we sit at the table with any of these states, we should get played. I mean, one of the biggest cases in point, Milton, is North Korea. Everything they have, whether it's their nuclear program, whether it's nuclear weapons, whether it's ballistic missiles, they've gotten against the backdrop of diplomacy with the West. There's no better example of failure.
I did a two-hour program once with Madeleine Albright. She was 4 days from the end of her term as Secretary of State, and she did a book and was on a tour and so on. And when I asked her about her visits to North Korea, she rather quickly changed the subject. But what, in fact, did she achieve, or rather, what did she lead us into in her friendship with, I forget the name of the second, the son of Kim Il-sung?
Let's just call him the dear leader.
The dear leader, exactly.
It was Kim Jong-il, but all of them are the dear leader.
Right. Was her dancing a waltz with him, which I think she did at one point, and making friendly utterances in various directions, apparently. Did that facilitate the march towards nuclearization and aggressiveness in the world undertaken by the guys in North Korea?
It did, absolutely. And this is part of a greater pattern in which second-term presidents oftentimes engage in foreign policy diplomatic adventures in order to have a Hail Mary pass with regard to their legacy. Uh-huh. Ronald Reagan, of course, did this with Saddam Hussein. Bill Clinton did this with regard to North Korea. George W. Bush also did it with regard to North Korea. He removed North Korea from the state sponsor of terrorism list. And Barack Obama seems to be doing it with absolutely everyone in the world at this point. The point is that we gave billions of dollars of aid to North Korea in terms of heavy fuel oil, in terms of technology, in terms of food assistance. That did nothing but bolster the regime.
But what promises did they give in return?
They promised to abide by certain provisions of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which they violated. Yeah. They promised to only distribute that food aid to their civilians, which they violated. When the U.S. General Accounting Office called them on this and called the State Department on this, the State Department's response was, well, if we hold them to account, that could ruin the diplomatic process, that the real problem is the fact that we tried to put so many controls on how they could use this aid. And what's actually scary, the same negotiator who negotiated these agreements with North Korea is now taking the lead in negotiating under the Obama administration with regard to Iran. The lesson that Wendy Sherman seems to have learned here is not that she should not prevent this sort of cheating, but rather she should keep these agreements secret so that no one can call her to account should our opponents cheat.
We are talking just a few days after the speech at West Point at the graduation exercises by President Barack Obama, which in many ways seemed to be signaling that we're going to be conciliatory and we're going to, as I said to Fred Kagan when we did a conversation on these same matters, that we're going to follow TR's adage, partly. We're going to speak softly and carry a wobbly stick. It seems to me that all of this is no great surprise in the speech at West Point, because it was in a way fully prefigured, or would you disagree, way back in the Cairo speech within just a month or so after his inauguration?
Well, you know, I found the West Point speech so instructive because it illustrated better than anything else just how little President Obama understands the purpose of the military. He looks at the military as a reactive tool in which policymakers can call upon to intervene here or there, but he had no appreciation for the importance of having the strongest, by far, military in the world as a means of deterring conflicts. When our military grows weak, that's ultimately when we see the eruption of conflicts. As you know, after Dean Acheson in January 1950 outlined the defensive perimeter in Asia of what the United States saw as a key interest, he omitted Korea. That led directly to the Korean War. Now when we are shrinking our army to pre-World War II levels, when the Navy under Jimmy Carter had more ships in the Pacific Ocean than we have in the entire world right now, we shouldn't be surprised that we see, just this resurgence of chaos, whether it's in Russia, whether it's in Iran, whether it's China and Southeast Asia and so forth.
I think if the next president is going to be the wife of the former president, that you're probably not going to be called to a high position in American statecraft. But if there is a Republican president, I could conceive it as quite possible that you would be brought out of your scholarly location at the moment and put back into action of helping to forge policy and to execute policy. So assuming we've got that latter kind of administration and you wind up either in defense or in state or in the White House, any or all of those would be possible, what would you be urging upon the new administration?
Well, ultimately, one of the things I think that the last several administrations have lacked is a coherent strategy. Now, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and President Obama made this analogy at West Point. Well, if you're a diplomat, everything looks like a subject for diplomatic talks. What we need is a National Security Council, which is willing to tell the diplomats, no, sometimes our most effective action is to walk away from the table, just like rather than simply legislate for the sake of legislating in Congress, sometimes it's better simply not to interfere. Now, my advice to the president would be, number one, we can't be afraid to walk away from the table. Number two, when it comes to diplomacy, we need to have metrics. We need to be able to gauge whether our diplomacy is working. Number three, one of the biggest metrics out there, which may seem counterintuitive when it comes to negotiating with rogue regimes, if you want to know whether a rogue has really come in from a cult, one of the things to look at is religious freedom. Because if they have had a sincere change of heart, chances are they're not stringing up their Christians, shooting their Jews, or burning down the houses of their Baha'is. Ultimately, that is the canary in the coal mine, which I think we need to look at a great deal more. And lastly, we shouldn't be sequencing our strategies. We need to be doing them coherently with economic, military, and diplomatic pressure all simultaneous.
I'm going to name a nation that we've not mentioned at all in this conversation and ask you what will be required by way of diplomacy or by way of military intimations, if not full military assault. I speak, of course, of the People's Republic of China.
Well, with regard to China, number one, we need to understand that simply talking without leverage isn't important. It may be painful, but we need to ensure that we have military dominance over China. That's important not only for ourselves and our own liberty, but also for our allies in the region. There's absolutely nothing wrong with talking to China, just like there is nothing wrong with talking to the Soviet Union, but we can't pretend that we can take shortcuts. Certainly, if we do, we will come out with the losing end of the stick there.
Is there anything scary going on now with regard to China's undertakings as they might affect us?
Well, you know, actually what scares me, and this may be more counterintuitive, is less the rise of China than the decline of China. A lot of people are assuming, and I'm not sure whether they're assuming on good data, that the rise of China is inevitable. But when you have a million people stranded at a train station, that's a recipe for unrest. When you have a Communist Party that is more interested in protecting corruption than in addressing it, that's not a good sign for the future. And likewise, when you go to Taiwan, you see, and I don't have the figures directly at my the figures at my fingertips, so I'm giving you an analogy. If the per capita income in Taiwan is $20,000 a year, if the per capita income in coastal China is $3,000 a year, then the per capita income in the interior of China is just $400 a year, and it's that sort of difference which is a formula for a great deal of unrest. The question is, if we have unrest, economic unrest in China, what if we have a Chinese leader who is as Machiavellian and aggressive as Vladimir Putin is in Russia? Are we going to be prepared for that?
There is a Roman adage, I think Vecetius or some such name, got it out a long time ago, 2nd or 3rd century AD, I think. Desideret pacem, preparat bellum. If you desire peace, prepare for war. You are committed to that same policy, are you not?
I am indeed. And, you know, one of the biggest differences I see between the right in the United States and the left when it comes to national security is that the left always demonizes power while the right sees that power can be used for good or for bad. Now, President Obama very much is to the left. What I don't think he and his advisors fully appreciate, however, is that if the United States isn't the most powerful nation on earth, it's not likely that altruistic forces are going to fill the vacuum left behind. Ultimately, I believe that's what we're seeing right now.
You are indeed, one senses, in the category of political scientist or historian that would be called realist, and your general strategic orientation is realism rather than what?
Well, ultimately, you know, I'm glad you asked that question because normally I'm identified as a neoconservative because I do believe in the supremacy of democracy and liberty and having a robust military. Where I differ with the realists and where I think that so many realists are distinctly unrealistic is when they look at things in terms of a cost-benefit analysis. They don't put enough emphasis on the value of friendship and the value of alliance. And ultimately, we're paying the price for that right now, that when we don't stand by our allies, the reverberations of that can last decades. ultimately, that is why I would not consider myself a realist in the way it's transmitted right now, simply because I'm against this idea of coddling our adversaries and bashing our allies.
Well, Michael Rubin, I thank you very much for joining us. We've just done a brief overview of what one finds in the excellently written new book by Michael Rubin, Dancing with the Devil, The Perils of Engaging Rogue Regimes, published by Encounter Books and well worth getting your hands on. Thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you, Milton.